And I must admit, I'm a bit confused about where we are in the text, too.
I have it
Well,
marked at the break on page 139.
Okay, so that's where I had
yeah.
it, but I thought I couldn't remember whether that was right or not.
I have the
yeah.
same, yes.
Yeah, I have that too.
I have the same, yes. Okay, 139. It is natural from the point of view. Okay.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay, I see.
Hi, Marco.
Jeffrey. Hi, Andrea. By the way, hi, everyone.
Glad you made it.
yeah. I'm so confused. I get everything. Well, people also give me as a present calendars, but it doesn't serve. It doesn't work out. So, Jeffrey, me, John, and Andrea.
I'll be right there. Just go ahead.
So.
Shall I do the bell? So we've been doing this because I have this bell on my computer. Because we've discovered that the
everybody's leaving.
Yeah, we've discovered that the Zoom does something odd to Andrea's bell, cuts the sound, like eats the sound.
Oh yeah, I've noticed.
So it seems to deal with my computerized bell better. So we've shall I go and then do a 3-minute meditation?
Yeah, so he and Andrea is here.
Yeah.
So we can start.
it is natural from the point of view of the yoga to divide into two categories the activities of the human mind in its pursuit of knowledge. There is the supreme supra-intellectual knowledge, which concentrates itself on the discovery of the one and infinite in its transcendence, or tries to penetrate by intuition, contemplation, direct inner contact into the ultimate truths behind the appearance of nature. There is the lower science, which diffuses itself in an outward knowledge of phenomena, the disguises of the one and infinite as it appears to us, in or through the more exterior forms of the world manifestation around us. These two, an upper and a lower hemisphere, in the form of them constructed or conceived by men within the mind's ignorant limits, have even there separated themselves as they developed with some sharpness. Philosophy, sometimes spiritual, or at least intuitive, sometimes abstract and intellectual, sometimes intellectualizing spiritual experience, or supporting with a logical apparatus the discoveries of the spirit, has claimed always to take the fixation of ultimate truth as its province. But even when it did not separate itself on rarefied metaphysical heights from the knowledge that belonged to the practical world and the pursuit of ephemeral objects, intellectual philosophy, by its habit of abstraction, has seldom been a power for life. It has been sometimes powerful for high speculation. Pursuing mental truth for its own sake without any ulterior utility or object, sometimes for a subtle gymnastic of the mind in the mistily bright cloudland of words and ideas, but it has walked or acrobatized far from the more tangible realities of existence. Ancient philosophy in Europe, was more dynamic, but only for the few. In India, in its more spiritualized forms, it strongly influenced, but without transforming the life of the race. Religion did not attempt, like philosophy, to live alone on the heights. Its aim was rather to take hold of man's parts of life, even more than his parts of mind, and draw them Godwards. It professed to build a bridge between spiritual truth and the vital and material human existence. It strove to subordinate and reconcile the lower to the higher, make life serviceable to God, earth obedient to heaven. It has to be admitted that too often this necessary effort had the opposite result of making heaven a sanction for earth's desires. For, continually, the religious idea has been turned into an excuse for the worship and service of the human ego. Religion, leaving constantly its little shining core of spiritual experience, has lost itself in the obscure mass of its ever-extending ambiguous compromises with life. In attempting to satisfy the thinking mind, it more often succeeded in impressing and fettering it with a mass of theological dogmas. While seeking to net the human heart, it fell itself into pits of pietistic emotionalism and sensationalism. In the act of annexing the vital nature of man to dominate it, it grew itself vitiated and fell a prey to all the fanaticism, homicidal fury, savage and harsh turn for oppression, pullulating falsehood, obstinate attachment to ignorance to which that vital nature is prone. its desire to draw the physical and man towards God, betraying it into chaining itself to ecclesiastic mechanism, hollow ceremony, and lifeless ritual. Oh, geez, this goes on and on. Sorry. The corruption of the best produced the worst by that strange chemistry of the power of life, which generates evil out of good, even as it can also generate good out of evil. At the same time, in a vain effort at self-defense against this downward gravitation, religion was driven to cut existence into two by a division of knowledge, works, art, life itself, into two opposite categories, the spiritual and the worldly, religious and mundane, spirit, sacred and profane. But this defensive distinction itself became conventional and artificial and aggravated rather than healed the disease. On their side, science and art and knowledge of life, although at first they served or lived in the shadow of religion, ended by emancipating themselves, became estranged or hostile, or have even recoiled with difference, contempt, or skepticism from what seemed to them the cold, barren, and distant or substantial and illusory heights of unreality to which metaphysical philosophy and religion aspire. For a time, the divorce has been as complete as the one-sided intolerance of the human mind could make it, and threatened even to end in a complete extinction of all attempt at a higher or more spiritual knowledge. Yet even in the earthward life, a higher knowledge is indeed the one thing that is throughout needful, and without it, the lower sciences and pursuits, however fruitful, however rich, free, miraculous in the abundance of their results, become easily a sacrifice offered without due order and to false gods, corrupting, hardening in the heart of man, limiting his mind's horizons. They confine in a stony material imprisonment or lead to a final baffling incertitude and disillusionment. A sterile agnosticism awaits us above the brilliant phosphorescence of a half knowledge that is still the ignorance. I don't disagree with the general argument, but such a lot of heavy judgment is not my style.
And you got also the longest.
Yes, I know. I realized that halfway into it, that I was going to be doing this for a while.
Yeah, in fact, very long. It's unconventional. Usually they are much, much smaller. Yeah. Yeah. Sometimes we see the dot, dot, dot. Is it original? I'm now looking at the dots.
Well, sorry, it's almost like a change of breath within the paragraph.
Yeah. I'm just wondering if they had a problem to transcribe the manuscript, the original. They could not read the words, perhaps.
Yeah, so an ellipsis, but I don't think so.
Oh, yeah, okay. So should I continue? Yeah. A yoga turned towards an all-embracing realization of the Supreme will not despise the works or even the dreams, if dreams they are, of the cosmic spirit, or shrink from the splendid toil and many-sided victory which he has assigned to himself and the human creature. But its first condition for this liberty is that our works in the world, too, must be part of the sacrifice offered to the highest and to none else, to the divine Shakti and to none other. Power in the right spirit and with the right knowledge by the free soul and not by the hypnotized bondslave of material nature. I read this sentence, but it's first condition. But its first condition for this liberty is that our works in the world too must be part of the sacrifice offered to the highest and to none else, to the divine Shakti and to none other power, in the right spirit and with the right knowledge, by the free soul and not by the hypnotized bond slave of material nature. If a division of works has to be made, it is between those that are nearest to the heart of the sacred flame and those that are least touched or illumined by it, because they are more at a distance, or between the fuel that burns strongly and brightly and the logs that, if too thickly heaped on the altar, may impede the ardor of the fire, or the fire, by their rather damp, heavy, and diffused abundance. So I have to read this also, because this is also quite long sentence. If a division of works has to be made, it is between those that are nearest to the heart of the sacred flame and those that are least touched or illumined by it, because they are more at a distance, or between the fuel that burns strongly and brightly and the logs that, if too thickly heaped on the altar, may impede the ardor of the fire by their rather damp, heavy, and diffused abundance. But otherwise, apart from this division, all activities of knowledge that seek after or express truths are in themselves rightful materials for a complete offering. None ought necessarily to be excluded from the wide framework of the divine life. The mental and physical sciences, which examine into the laws and forms of processes of things, those which concern the life of men and animals, the social, political, linguistic, and historical, and those which seek to know and control the labors and activities by which man subdues and utilizes his world and environment, and the noble and beautiful arts which are at once work and knowledge, for every well-made and significant poem, picture, statue, or building is an act of creative knowledge, a living discovery of the consciousness, a figure of truth, a dynamic form of mental and vital self-expression or world expression. All that seeks, all that finds, all that voices or fears is a realization of something of the play of the infinite, and to that extent can be made a means of God realization or of divine formation. But the yogin has to see that it is no longer done as part of an ignorant mental life. It can be accepted by him only if, by the feeling, the remembrance, the dedication within it, it is turned into a movement of the spiritual consciousness and becomes a part of its vast grasp of comprehensive, illuminating knowledge.
For all must be done as a sacrifice. All activities must have the one divine for their object and the heart of their meaning. The yogin's aim in the sciences that make for knowledge should be to discover and understand the workings of the divine consciousness puissance in man and creatures and things and forces, her creative significances, her execution of the mysteries, the symbols in which she arranges the manifestation. The yogin's aim in the practical sciences, whether mental and physical or occult and psychic, should be to enter into the ways of the divine and his processes, to know the materials and means for the work given to us, so that we may use that knowledge for a conscious and faultless expression of the spirit's mastery, joy, and self-fulfillment. The yogin's aim in the arts should not be a mere aesthetic, mental, or vital gratification, but seeing the divine everywhere, worshiping it with a revelation of the meaning of its own works, to express that one divine in ideal forms, the one divine in principles and forces, the one divine in gods and men and creatures and objects. The theory that sees an intimate connection between religious aspiration and the truest and greatest art is in essence right. But we must substitute for the mixed and doubtful religious motive a spiritual aspiration, vision, interpreting experience. For the wider and more comprehensive the seeing, the more it contains in itself the sense of the hidden divine in humanity and in all things, and rises beyond a superficial religiosity into the spiritual life, the more luminous, flexible, deep, and powerful will the art be that springs from that high motive. Dogen's distinction from other men is this, that he lives in a higher and vaster spiritual consciousness. All his work of knowledge or creation must then spring from there. It must not be made in the mind, for it is a greater truth and vision than mental man's that he has to express, or rather that presses to express itself through him and mold his works, not for his personal satisfaction, but for a divine purpose.
At the same time, the yogin who knows the Supreme is not subject to any need or compulsion in these activities. For to him, they are neither a duty nor a necessary occupation for the mind, nor a high amusement, nor imposed by the loftiest human purpose. He is not attached, bound, and limited by any, nor has he any personal motive of fame, greatness, or personal satisfaction in these works. He can leave or pursue them as the divine in him wills, but he need not otherwise abandon them in his pursuit of the higher integral knowledge. He will do these things just as the supreme power acts and creates for a certain spiritual joy in creation and expression, or to help in the holding together and right ordering or leading of this world of God's workings. The Gita teaches that the man of knowledge shall by his way of life give to those who have not yet the spiritual consciousness the love and habit of all works, and not only of actions recognized as pious, religious, or ascetic in their character. He should not draw men away from the world action by his example. For the world must proceed in its great upward aspiring. Men and nations must not be led to fall away from even an ignorant activity into a worse ignorance of inactions, or to sink down into that miserable disintegration and tendency of disillusion which comes upon communities and peoples when there predominates the tamasic principle, the principle whether of obscure confusion and error or of weariness and inertia. For I too, says the Lord in the Gita, have no need to do works, since there is nothing I have not or must yet gain for myself. Yet I do works in the world, for if I did not do works, all laws would fall into confusion. The worlds would sink towards chaos, and I would be the destroyer of these peoples. The spiritual life does not need for its purity to destroy interest in all things, except the inexpressible, or to cut at the roots of the sciences, the arts, and life. It may well be one of the effects of an integral spiritual knowledge and activity, substitute for our mind's ignorant, limited, tepid, or trepidant pleasure in them, a free, intense, and uplifting urge of delight, and supply a new source of creative spiritual power and illumination by which they can be carried more swiftly and profoundly towards their absolute light in knowledge and their yet undreamed possibilities and most dynamic energy of content and form and practice. The one thing needful must be pursued first and always, but all things else come with it as its outcome and have not so much to be added to us as recovered and reshaped in its self-light and as portions of its self-expressive force. I need to do that again. The one thing needful must be pursued first and always, but all things else come with it as its outcome and have not so much to be added to us as recovered and reshaped in its self-light and as portions of its self-expressive force. And have not so much to be added? It just sounds like there needs to be another part of a sentence. And have not so much to be added to us as recovered and reshaped in its self-light and as portions of its self-expressive force. Do you get that as a complete sentence?
I think it is complete, but all things else come with it as its outcome and have not so much to be added to us as recovered and reshaped and as portions of self-expressive force.
Thank you. There it is. Yeah. Thank you.
Whew. Do we stop there and discuss since there's a break? Or I kind of not very much enjoying this part of the reading. I don't know about
that. Not either.
It feels heavy, and it's interesting because he says in that part that we read a bit back here, at the bottom of page 141, he says, was that long sentence? If a division of works has to be made, it is between those who are nearest to the heart of the sacred flame and those that are least touched or illumined by it, which I really like. But then he goes on, because they are more at a distance, or between the fuel that burns strongly and brightly and the logs that, if too thickly heaped on the halter, may impede the ardor of the fire by their rather damp, heavy, and diffused abundance. I kind of like to apply that to its own writing here because it's all layered on too thick and you don't get to the light part of it. So it's like self-expressive.
Yes.
I don't understand this sentence, but several sentences here. But I think the essence of the message that I get here, it is something. There's more prophecy than anything else. He's describing what is probably coming according to his vision, rather than a personal yoga, a sort of what he called subjective age, where arts, sciences, and so on, every activity, human activity that actually comes mainly from the mind, the intellect, will be raised to something that goes beyond mind and the intellect. That's the, and this is also for religion. Yeah, religion, arts, sciences, and so on. Poetry, he also wrote the future poetry, by the way, he also wrote once, that's the essence of the chapter that I'm getting here now. And this will come through this ascent of the sacrifice. Only when there will be this turn inward of us, then this will become also almost automatic in the society as a whole. That's how I understand it. When it comes to the single sentences, yes, there are some really, yeah.
But I appreciate your synopsis of that, Marco. It helps me situate what we've just read more clearly.
The end of this last paragraph that I just read reminded me of what we read yesterday in the Vedas about the ashrams, to be carried more swiftly and profoundly towards their absolute light. So the ashrams are the gods of delight that keep carrying us upwards into more and more delight. That was a nice moment there for me. John, Robert, you got something to enlighten us with?
I don't think so, but I was just appreciating this part in the paragraph that you read, Andrea, about how the spiritual life is not out to destroy the roots of the sciences or the arts or life, but to lift them out of their limitations. Mm-hmm. And I've just been reading I guess it's a biography of Joan of Arc. And the author goes through in great, immense detail the machinations that were going on in France during the time before she appeared on the scene. All the internal battles among the aristocracy and the inability of the royalty to do their job. And I mean, just wow, what a mess. I think it was part of the Hundred Years' War. So I mean, it just went on and on and on and on and on and on. And so I think when and she also talks about the church and the wise proclamations of the church, you know, and the different sects, or I mean, it was all Catholic, but the different schools that would debate with one another about, you know, this part of the truth or that part of the truth. And it just seemed like a morass, the way she describes it. Of course, you know, I don't know. And then I've just gotten to the part where Joan appears on the scene, and she's like a sword, cuts through it all, you know, from the weakness and refusal of the king to rule, to all the machinations and distortions and manipulations of the leaders of the different French and English forces that were fighting one another and each other. And wow, what a mess.
So you relate this to a power struggle.
Oh, there were power struggles within power struggles within power struggles in all on all different levels.
Yeah.
Mm. Which ultimately killed her, right? Actually, as it was.
Yeah, I haven't gotten to that part of the story yet. She just, in the part I'm reading now, she's just appeared on the scene. And of course, nobody believes her, but she has such force. And she's not even literate. But she dictates these proclamations to the English that are besieging Orléans and tells them that she's going to drive them out. And she's just a girl, you know? She's 17 or 18 years old, never been in the army, but these kind of sword-like blasts come out from her. And it's just astounding. But I was relating it to the part where the spiritual life can uplift these different tangled mess of things that we can make sometimes.
Yeah, but the point that Albert tried to make is you are referring to the power struggle. But I think that this mess that you are describing is also in us, in the sciences, and in not only in politics, but in our everyday living, in arts, in our way of thinking, and that we make a lot of intricacies and mental constructions which are hollow, so to speak, when we see it from a higher perspective, and where the power structure is only one of the aspects of this hollow structure and hollow life system, sciences, arts, whatever, religions, by the way, also. So in this sense, I'm not contradicting you. I say only, this is only one, the aspect of the power struggle in the political system. But we have this also in our schools, in our education system, in our way of thinking, of what we believe, our belief systems, that we don't burn on the stake, no one, hopefully, but the contrivances, the complications of our lives arise from that. That's what I mean. And if it is not, if there is not this new source of creative spiritual power and illumination and self-expressing force, when this is lacking, and I personally see this very much in the science today. Yeah, I think science as it is today is in a sort of stagnation, state of stagnation, which might sound outrageous because people say, well, how don't you see all the progress, all the things? And but it's only a superficial way of seeing. So I think this lack of spiritual illumination is not only in politics, that's what I wanted to say. It's everywhere, in every human activity. And we don't need to be neither a hero nor a criminal. It is in every one of us, in a certain sense. That's why we are human. Okay. I'm digressing, perhaps. It's full stop.
There's a book called The Molecules of Emotion that Karen and I read some time back. And it's about this woman who made some really interesting discoveries in the field of science and the battles she went through with competition and you know, her superiors and her colleagues trying to squash her. And just, I mean, it was really illustrated that kind of thing going on in the scientific world that you were talking about.
Yeah, absolutely.
I just want to check with everyone. Did you just hear John Roberts' voice kind of slipping away because of the connection? Okay, I'm going to get out and come back in because second time this has happened.
Yes, a couple of times it happened to me, but it was not so disturbing for me, at least. I think it's almost normal. So,
we'll start to think of human communication as having these instabilities in it, just because Zoom has become the whole world of communication.
Yeah.
I think Zoom is expressing outwardly something that's in us.
Yeah.
Shall I go on?
Yeah, okay.
This then is the true relation between divine and human knowledge. It is not a separation into disparate fields, sacred and profane, that is the heart of the difference, but the character of consciousness behind the working. All is human knowledge that proceeds from the ordinary mental consciousness interested in the outside or upper layers of things, in process, in phenomena for their own sake, or for the sake of some surface utility or mental or vital satisfaction of desire or of the intelligence. But the same activity of knowledge can become part of the yoga if it proceeds from the spiritual or spiritualizing consciousness, which seeks and finds in all that it surveys or penetrates the presence of the timeless eternal and the ways of manifestation of the eternal in time. It is evident that the need of a concentration indispensable for the transition out of the ignorance may make it necessary for the seeker to gather together his energies and focus them only on that which will help the transition, and to leave aside or subordinate for the time all that is not directly turned towards the one object. He may find that this or that pursuit of human knowledge with which he was accustomed to deal by the surface power of the mind still brings him, by reason of this tendency or habit, out of the depths to the surface or down from the heights which he has climbed or is nearing to lower levels. These activities then may have to be intermitted or put aside until, securing a higher consciousness, he's able to turn its powers on all the mental fields. Then, subjected to that light or taken up into it, they are turned by the transformation of his consciousness into a province of the spiritual and divine. All that cannot be so transformed or refuses to be part of a divine consciousness, he will abandon without hesitation, but not from any preconceived prejudgment of its unfitness or its incapacity to be an element of the new inner life. There can be no fixed mental test or principle for those things. He will therefore follow no unalterable rule, but accept or repel an activity of the mind according to his feeling, insight, or experience until the greater power and light are there to turn their unerring scrutiny on all that is below and choose or reject the material out of what the human evolution has prepared for the divine labor.
How precisely or by what stages this progression and change will take place must depend on the form, need, and powers of the individual nature. In the spiritual domain, the essence is always one, but there is yet an infinite variety, and at any rate in the integral yoga, the rigidity of a strict and precise mental rule is seldom applicable. For even when they walk in the same direction, no two natures proceed on exactly the same lines, in the same series of steps, or with quite identical stages of their progress. May yet be said that a logical succession of the states of progress would be very much in this order. First, there is a large turning in which all the natural mental activities proper to the individual nature are taken up or referred to a higher standpoint and dedicated by the soul in us, the psychic being, the priest of the sacrifice, to the divine service. Next, there is an attempt to an ascent of the being and a bringing down of the light and power proper to some new height of consciousness gained by its upward effort into the whole action of the knowledge. Here there may be a strong concentration of the inward central change of consciousness and an abandonment of a large part of the outward going mental life, or else its relegation to a small and subordinate place. At different stages, it or parts of it may be taken up again from time to time to see how far the new inner psychic and spiritual consciousness can be brought into its movements. But that compulsion of the temperament or the nature which in human beings necessitates one kind of activity or another and makes it seem almost an indispensable portion of the existence will diminish, and eventually no attachment will be left, no lower compulsion or driving force felt anywhere. Only the divine will matter. The divine alone will be the one need of the whole being. If there is any compulsion to activity, it will be not that of implanted desire or a force of nature, but the luminous driving of some greater consciousness force, which is becoming more and more the sole motive power of the whole existence. On the other hand, it is possible at any period of the inner spiritual progress that one may experience an extension rather than a restriction of activities. There may be an opening of new capacities of mental creation and new provinces of knowledge by the miraculous touch of the yoga shakti. As aesthetic feeling, the power of artistic creation in one field or many fields together, talent or genius of literary expression, a faculty of metaphysical thinking, any power of the eye or ear or hand or mind power may awaken where none was apparent before. The divine within may throw these latent riches out from the depths in which they were hidden, or a force from above may pour down its energies to equip the instrumental nature for the activity of the creation of which it is meant to be a channel or a builder. But whatever may be the method or the course of development chosen by the hidden master of the yoga, the common culmination of this stage is the growing consciousness of him alone as the mover, decider, shaper of all the movements of the mind and all the activities of knowledge.
There are two signs of the transformation of the seeker's mind of knowledge and works of knowledge from the process of the ignorance to the process of a liberated consciousness, working partly then wholly in the light of the spirit. There is first a central change of the consciousness and a growing direct experience, vision, feeling of the supreme and the cosmic existence, the divine in itself and the divine in all things. The mind will be taken up into a growing preoccupation with this first and foremost, and will feel itself heightening, widening into a more and more illumined means of expression of the one fundamental knowledge. But also the central consciousness in its turn will take up more and more the outer mental activities of knowledge and turn them into a parcel of itself or an annexed province. It will infuse into them its more authentic movement and make a more and more spiritualized and illumined mind its instrument in these surface fields, its new conquests, as well as in its own deeper spiritual empire. And this will be the second sign, the sign of a certain completion and perfection. that the divine himself has become the knower, and all the inner movements, including the activities of what was once a purely human mental action, have become his field of knowledge. There will be less and less individual choice, opinion, preference, less and less of intellectualization, mental weaving, cerebral galley slave labor. A light within will see all that has to be seen, know all that has to be known, develop, create, organize. It will be the inner knower who will do in the liberated and universalized mind of the individual the works of an all-comprehending knowledge.
These two changes are the signs of a first effectuation in which the activities of the mental nature are lifted up, spiritualized, widened, universalized, liberated, led to a consciousness of their true purpose as an instrumentation of the divine, creating and developing its manifestation in the temporal universe. But this cannot be the whole scope of the transformation, for it is not in these limits that the integral seeker can cease from his ascension or can find the widening of his nature. For if it were so, knowledge would still remain a working of the mind, liberated, universalized, spiritualized, but still, as all mind must be, comparatively restricted, relative, imperfect in the very, very essence of its dynamism. It would reflect luminously great constructions of truth, but not move in the domain where truth is authentic, direct, sovereign, and native. There is an ascension still to be made from this height, by which the spiritualized mind will exceed itself and transmute into a supramental power of knowledge. Process of spiritualization having to pass out of the liberty of the human.
Andrea, you're frozen.
Yeah, your image is frozen, Andrea. Yeah. And we can't hear you talking right now.
Yeah. Do you hear us, Andrea? You are almost frozen.
Uh-oh.
Yes, now I hear you.
So
perhaps it's better that just you go out and in again. Perhaps it works better. Yeah. Is it COVID? It has affected the internet. So, do you see us, hear us?
Yes.
Yeah, now you seem more fluid, yes.
I keep shutting down. My connection must not be very good. Mm. You can hear me now,
is
okay?
Perhaps it's position. Are you through Wi-Fi?
No, I'm always here. Yeah, I'm on Wi-Fi, but okay. I'm on a local internet server and sometimes...
I think... we lost you where you said there is an ascension still to be made from this hate.
Oh, there already. I'm sorry.
Or no, perhaps you will.
I'll just start there.
Yeah, okay.
There is an ascension still to be made from this height by which the spiritualized mind will exceed itself and transmute into a supramental power of knowledge. Already in the process of spiritualization, it will have begun to pass out of the brilliant poverty of the human intellect. It will mount successively into the pure, broad reaches of a higher mind, and next into the gleaming belts of a still greater free intelligence, illumined with a light from above. At this point, we'll begin to feel more freely, admit with a less mixed response the radiant beginnings of an intuition, not illumined, but luminous in itself, true in itself, no longer entirely mental and therefore subjected to the abundant intrusion of error. Here too is not an end, for it must rise beyond into the very domain of that untruncated intuition, the first direct light from the self-awareness of essential being, and beyond it, attain that from which this light comes, mind, a power more original and dynamic which supports mind, sees it as a diminished radiation from itself, uses it as a transmitting belt of passage downward or an instrument for the creations of the ignorance. The last step of the ascension would be the surpassing of overmind itself, or its return into its own still greater origin, its conversion into the supramental light of the divine gnosis. For there in the supramental light is the seat of the divine truth consciousness that has native in it, as no other consciousness below it can have, the power to organize the works of a truth which is no longer tarnished by the shadow of the cosmic inconscience and ignorance. There to reach and thence to bring down a supramental dynamism that can transform the ignorance is the distant but imperative supreme goal of the integral yoga. Wow.
So this is, he talks about this overmind, which is intermediate between below supermind, right? Super.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So I'm still a bit struggling with this idea, actually.
Between mind and supermind, yes. It's
no,
the region.
Between what is overmind, exactly. Yeah.
It's in between.
I know, but what does that mean? Yeah.
We'll find out when we get there.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Good point.
Yeah, I think this was the best answer.
The mother talks about it in terms, she says, this is like a child's story. So take it as just a story, because it's really hard to talk about from a mental point of view, from a lower mind point of view. But she says that originally, the first part of the manifestation, the original manifestation, was four powers, four great powers of light and truth and bliss. And there was a fourth one.
Being.
The divine, the manifestation was created and intended with the principle of freedom in it. And so each of these four powers began to develop, had the freedom to develop itself and its view of the world, until it was like there were four different versions. And at the beginning of that, these four versions were still connected to the one. They were all part of the unity. And then there was this turn that happened. And each of the four powers said, no, I am the one. I am it. And so each then became the shadow of itself, because it disconnected itself from the one. And so the overmind, Sri Aurobindo calls it the realm of the gods, because this is a place of great power and light. And right at the top of the overmind is where the overmind disappears or blends into the unity, into everything as one. And but Sri Aurobindo and Mother said, in our world, there's this lid between the lower realm, which goes up to the overmind and stops, and the supermind, which is a unity consciousness, but is also aware of diversity. So the overmind is the last step, and it's these powers that are really great and powerful, and to the extent that they're not connected to the unity from which they came, they're part of the lower hemisphere.
It's interesting. That reminds me of the story at the basis of Christianity, is that Lucifer, he was an angel of light, didn't want to follow orders and descended, and then became a shadow, brought shadow in.
Became
it's
Satan,
kind of
yeah.
similar to what you're describing. Yeah.
Yeah, Mother says that this is a really ancient tradition of these four powers. And she says in some of the traditions that came forward to our time, parts of that tradition were lost. And she names Christianity and Judaism and Christianity as an example where the Lucifer, light bearer, that part of the tradition survived the passage of time. And in other traditions, other parts of it had survived. But that was a really ancient tradition on which both the Vedic and the Chaldean traditions were built, this more ancient one, she says. And so that's, she tells that to the kids, the children at the ashram school, as a story, so they'll have some idea of understanding these different levels of mind, especially the overmind and the supermind. And she also says that supermind, basically, it's a technical term. It just means what's beyond overmind. With our mentality, we can hardly imagine it. Mm-hmm. And of course, Sri Aurobindo does try to describe it in Savitri. But it's really hard for us to grasp, because that part was closed to us until the supramental manifestation happened. And the four powers, the four horsemen, the four dark powers are still have very strong forces in the world. But I agree, Jeffrey, this is hard to, Sri Aurobindo has these four levels and he just described them here. There's the higher mind, there's the illuminative mind, there's the intuitive mind or intuition, and there's the overmind. Those are the four levels of mind above ordinary mind. And he describes it in the life divine. But I think it's hard, at least it's hard for me to remember what's this and what's that. And again, I don't know if it's all that important, but I like Mother's story.
But I find it also interesting that, as far as I know, we have in all the traditions, in all the times, in all the cultures, you have this idea of the angels and demons, the good and the bad spirits, the negative and the positive forces. I can't imagine that this is just a coincidence. Nowadays, we could say, well, I transmitted this idea throughout the internet. No. But once upon a time, we were all cultures almost completely isolated. And so there must be, in this story, which is told to children, and we find it everywhere, this idea of these beings that have fallen from the light and others who remained in the light. No? And what I think this also represents is a sort of fragmentation, no? Where in the supermind we have this perfect unity. There's nothing that is not seen and conceived from the point of view of unity. whereas the overmind is already the first step in the particularization and the fragmentation and the polarities. That's, I think, the characteristic. I can remind Mother, I don't know where she said that, that she says that gods, the gods who live in this over-mental world have a big ego and they fight each other. Also the gods, not only the fallen beings, the demons, because they are already in a domain where the ego has formed. Ego is a sort of particularization, of crystallization from the one to the many. No? And so this is perhaps also another way of... But in any case, I think he will amply describe all this stuff. He has already done this in the Life Divine. And he will do it, I think, again and again over also the rest of the synthesis. We will encounter this over mind and supermind and these various stages from mind, higher mind, illumined mind, intuitive mind, and then over mind and supermind. We'll describe it later.
But it's interesting what you're saying about, because it's one of the things, questions I am formulated since starting in on the Vedas, that in a lot of ways, the religions that came after the Vedas, the Judaism, Christianity, whatever, Buddhism, they seem almost a restriction of what was present in the Vedas, almost like a step down rather than a step up, you know what I mean? Or a step, I suppose they were a step forward in some sense, but I'm still trying to understand why that happened, you know? Because a lot of the truths that are present in the Vedas seem to, I mean, why would you want to throw that out and create something else in its place? I'm not...
So you mean that they were in contact somehow, these cultures? I mean, the Christianity
I think the Vedas were, they were part of the human tradition for these cultures.
They were not worldwide. But not worldwide. I mean, the Vedas were known in Europe, I don't know, in the 7th, 18th century, not much sooner. Huh? So, or if there was someone, it was only very, very, very extremely few. Huh? Those who went, Marco Polo, maybe he knew something about that.
I don't know, because I don't know from my readings. Okay, my readings in the Islam traditions, the Vedas were very present in the background for Islam traditions, but I also think they may have been present as background for Christianity to some extent. I don't know.
I didn't know that. Yeah. I recently read a bit of the philosophy of Plotinus. Plotinus, a Greek philosopher. If you would tell me that he was a Vedantic scholar, I would believe you. But it's nobody found so far any historic evidence that he was in contact with the Vedas. And I tend to believe that these things you find, not because there is a culture that transmits this information to another culture, but because the human beings find in themselves these truths.
Buddhism came directly out of the Vedas, right? It was a split. Yeah. Yeah. It was a split from the Vedas. So,
yes, but this was in the Indian continent.
Yes.
So these cultures were in contact with each other.
Yeah. Yeah.
But a guy as Plotinus when was it? Is it second BC? I don't know. Don't remember now. It's hard to
I don't know.
Imagine how he knew all that stuff.
I think there was a lot of rubbing between the different cultures in that period. Again, I did all this heavy reading about the background of, I was interested in Zoroastrianism and how all of the different currents moved through, the Middle East. Middle East was the crucible in which all of this happened, right? But the Middle East is connected to the Indian subcontinent on the one side and Europe on the other. I mean, that's where it sits, right? So it has a kind of a contact with what's going on in the Indian world and a contact with what's going on with the European world. So I think there was a lot more movement than we tend to think. Anyway.
Yeah.
There's an English scholar, Peter Kingsley, who's written about the spiritual origin of Western civilization. And he has very highly footnoted, so very highly documented, a tradition that there was a connection between Mongolia and early Greek philosophers, in particular Parmenides and Pythagoras, this connection was a shamanic connection. There was a shaman that came to bring this knowledge, and that then he also talks about the relationship between this Mongolian shamanism and the spirituality that developed in India after that. It's really interesting stuff. And I mean, how much of it has not been documented?
Yeah.
I mean, how much of these exchanges that we've been talking about have not been recorded in any way that we can tell? But this is a really interesting one, and particularly Kingsley is trying to bring back the knowledge of the sacred at the Western tradition and its beginnings. In the Greeks, before Christianity. So I don't know, but.
Because I also read this other series of texts about the axial revolution, this idea that Buddhism, Christianity, and came out of a socio-cultural context, and in a sense, they emerged with the formation of the nation state. In a sense, that the monotheistic religions, were integrated into the process of the formation of the nation state. And so that it was part of a social economic reorganization of society, and the idea of a single nation went with a monotheistic religion. The two kind of parallel each other and feed off each other. So that's a different kind of understanding of what's going on than a purely spiritual sense. But it still seems in some ways as a kind of a step down than a step up. Although maybe today, when the nation state is beginning to break down, we have more affinity with the Vedic tradition than we do with the monotheistic traditions, which are focused on the nation state as the primary vehicle, and we're losing the nation state now. So maybe there's something there as well.
Interesting, like an opening and closing of the collective mind space. That's what I'm hearing.
I propose to finish reading my last paragraph, and then it's a break, and we can stop there if that's okay.
Who was? Was it my turn?
No, it's my turn.
Ah, your turn? Okay.
Yeah. As the light. Okay. Go ahead, Andrea.
Okay. Did John Robert just read? I thought it was.
Sorry. It's your turn. Your turn then. Okay.
So, are we starting with as the light of each of these?
Yes.
Is that where we start? Okay. Is my voice coming through okay?
Yep.
Okay. As the light of each of these higher powers is turned upon the human activities of knowledge, any distinction of sacred and profane, human and divine, begins more and more to fade until it is finally abolished as otios. What does otios mean?
We had this discussion before and I said it was hateful and it turned out that was wrong. That's all I remember.
Maybe odious.
Let's see.
Otios and odious.
Serving no practical purpose or result.
Do that again?
Serving no practical purpose.
Oh, okay.
So not odious, but useless.
Right. For whatever is touched and thoroughly penetrated by the divine gnosis is transfigured and becomes a movement of its own light and power, free from the turbidity and limitations of the lower intelligence. It is not a separation of some activities, but a transformation of them all, by the change of the informing consciousness, that is the way of liberation, an ascent of the sacrifice of knowledge to a greater and ever greater light and force. All the works of mind and intellect must be first heightened and widened, then illumined, lifted into the domain of a higher intelligence, afterwards translated into workings of a greater non-mental intuition, then again transformed into the dynamic outpourings of the overmind radiance, and these transfigured into the full light and sovereignty of the supramental gnosis. It is this that the evolution of consciousness in the world carries, prefigured, but latent in its seed, and in the straining, tense intention of its process. Nor can that process, that evolution, cease till it has evolved the instruments of a perfect in place of its now, till it has evolved the instruments of a perfect in place of its now imperfect manifestation of the spirit. So I really like this last, because it seems such a beautiful synopsis. I'm going to read it again. All the works of mind and intellect must first be heightened and widened, then illumined, lifted into the domain of a higher intelligence, afterwards translated into workings of a greater non-mental intuition, then again transformed into the dynamic outpourings of the overmind radiance, and these transfigured into the full light and sovereignty of the supramental gnosis. It is this that the evolution of consciousness in the world carries, prefigured, but latent in its seed, than in the straining tense intention of its process. Nor can that process, that evolution, cease till it has evolved the instruments of a perfect in place of a perfect in place of its now imperfect manifestation of the spirit.
Great. I will stop here.
I like the clarity of that last part. It seems to really clearly describe the process.
How would you summarize it, if I may ask?
I think that to me that was a summary, but anybody want to summarize a summary?
Summarize a summary, yeah. Could we say a transmutation? He's describing transmutation of the mind, intelligence, into something that goes beyond.
Yeah, so the stepping, another stepping stone, another stepping stone.
Yeah. By steps.
Mind to higher mind, vision to overmind, to the totality.
He later on also describes the so-called mind of light. One of his last writings. He adds still another piece in the puzzle just to simplify things. Yeah. Okay.
Yes, simple this is not.
No. Perhaps we shouldn't try to understand it. Because when we try to understand it, then we're still looking at it with the mind, no?
Well, yeah, and the mind is at a loss in these realms, yeah, right?
It hurts. Oh, awfully. No, really. Thinking too much is... Then the best ideas come when you don't think. That's my experience, at least. Okay.
That has always been my understanding of why science has such a difficulty with grappling with consciousness, because they're trying to grapple with consciousness from the level of the mind. And
it's impossible. Have you gone through a bit the book and there?
Oh, I read the whole thing. I read it in 1972.
Yeah. No, I mean, because you said... because you said that you have taken... You have my book where I describe precisely that, what you have said. It's still coming, arriving.
Oh, yes, of course. Yeah.
This thing with consciousness is a mystery for science. And they will not be able to deconstruct it from the materialistic point of view. That's my opinion, at least. They will not be able to do that. And it's easy to show, in a certain sense. You just show that by their own research, they cannot explain it. It remains a deep mystery.
Mind has kind of a difficulty admitting that there might be states beyond its own rational everything.
Exactly. This is a form of anthropomorphism, no? Anthropocentrism. No? Thinking that the mind is the last stage of the ladder.
Right.
And many intellectuals believe that mind is the last, is everything. It's ridiculously anthropomorph, this idea. Okay. So I think
the simple question, why would we think that we are the last step in evolution? That to me is such a simple question. It's like, no. What a mess we are.
Yeah.
there must be something beyond this.
Yeah. If this is all what God was able to do, then he must give me some explanations and excuses also. I need excuses from God. If this is all what you were able to do, please shut up, close all the thing. Let's retire in some nirvana and that's all. And yeah, that's why I like this evolutionary cosmology of Aurobindo. It gives you also some hope for the future. Well, we hope. Okay, so we made a couple of minutes of meditation.
Thanks, everybody.
Thank you.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Bye.